do check that out. I'd just like to make a special note, which is that unfortunately neither Simon Lloyd nor Robert Curran were able to attend the festival in the end, but we are very happy to welcome Jesse Fawcett, Managing Director, Galafilm International, as well as Julie Bristow, Executive Director, Factual Entertainment, CBC Television. And we'd also like to thank the Canadian Television Fund for sponsoring all of our conference sessions, and a special thanks to C21media.net. And at this point, I'd like to introduce Jen Kuzmic from C21media.net, and she will introduce the rest of the panelists. Thanks.
Hello, welcome. Thank you so much for coming. For those of you that are not familiar with C21, it's an international trade publisher specialized in the business of television, mobile, and broadband content. I also edit Factual Week, which is a weekly online newsletter looking at the world of factual television and documentary. We're going to delve into the world of factual television today. And not just any factual television, however, content that's entertaining, popular, and marketable around the world. And that's why the title of this session is Putting the Fun into Factual. Just off the top, what I'd like to do is sort of get a feel for who's in the audience. How many producers, filmmakers, are in the audience? Okay, lots. Distributors, any? Okay. And of the producers and filmmakers that are here, have you done factual television before? Okay, so good. Great. All right. Well, what I'm going to do is, off the top, just get right to the panel. We're going to talk to the people up here, and this is for you as well. So we're, each person is going to sort of introduce himself. We're going to see some clips, and then feel free to ask questions. There are people with microphones around. And you can sort of find out what you would like to find out about this topic. Immediately to my left, we have Guy O'Sullivan. He is president of Proffer Television. Beside Guy is Vanessa Case, who is vice president of content for Slice and National Geographic at Alliance Atlantis Communications. Then we have Jesse Fawcett, who is managing director of distribution for Galafilm International. And last but certainly not least is Julie Bristow, who is the executive director of Factual Entertainment for CBC Television. I'm just going to turn it over to Guy, who is going to introduce Proffer.
Right. Well, Proffer Television is a company that started 2.5 years ago. First show we did was a show called Canada's Worst Driver, which has done fairly well, and we're now gearing up to do our third season of that this summer. We also have a sister show called Canada's Worst Handyman, which is a few billboards around town for it as I speak. That was the sort of launch pad for the company. Since then, we've done a couple of UK-Canada co-productions. And we're now sort of edging into the kind of format business, factual entertainment. Oh, sorry, am I a bit quiet? Oh, yeah. So we have a show with Vanessa now called Newlywed, Nearly Dead, which is a fact-ent format that's also now being represented by C4i to distribute internationally. And we've just recently done a deal with Cam West as well to do a pop doc series called TV Made Me Do It, basically about how television has warped the people that watch it. So that's kind of where we are to date. And there's a few other irons in the fire. So that's Proffer Television.
Do you want to roll the Proffer clip so we can see?
Oh, yeah. Should I give it a quick? Just to explain the thing you're about to watch, I just wanted to come up with something that spoke to the fun in factual. This is just a moment where we tried to basically teach people why it's not a good idea to multitask while driving. So they basically had to drive around and around in a circle, very simple, and eat a sandwich, put a CD on, have a drink. And then half the population obviously are known to at times apply makeup while driving, so we thought it was only fair if we asked all of the participants, including the men, to do exactly that. So that's the fun bit, in theory at least.
The next exercise for Canada's worst drivers should teach them that multitasking has no place behind the wheel. For pregnant Shannon, this lesson is twice as important.
I do all the things while driving. Talking on the phone, eating, doing my makeup. It's not my color, I have to tell you. I definitely now have a sense of how much worse I drive while doing these things.
Shannon had better change her ways, or Karen might report her to the police.
If I'm in the passenger seat, I grab the cell phone and I call them in.
That's right. Karen, a fourth-generation police wife, tells on drivers if she sees them applying makeup.
Yeah, especially women with the mascara and the lipstick.
Why not tell on the men applying lipstick?
I'm manage it, sort of, not very well.
But Michael sums up our point very well.
Anybody who's stupid enough to try to adjust makeup while driving is, at very best, an unmitigated fool. And I am not applying that just to women. There are lots of guys who wear makeup these days, let's face it.
Well done.
There you go.
So I am, I work on Slice Channel, and, or Slice, I should be saying, and National Geographic Channel, and Canada. And as many people might know, I'll lean in a bit more. Many people might know that Slice was formerly Life Network. It relaunched on March 5th. And just to address that channel first, that's where we're going to watch a clip from. That, I think this session is very much what Slice is all about. It's entirely a factual network. There is no drama or scripted material on that channel of any kind. And so the fact that we are only a factual channel, it's about bringing entertainment into factual programming and make it first and foremost the most important thing that we deliver to our audiences. And we're doing that to an 18 to 49 demographic, targeting women, but definitely speaking to a split demo. We've seen a rise in men watching the channel since its launch. So we know that we're appealing to the right group, and we are bringing entertainment to the forefront. And I believe very much that comes hand in hand with really terrific casting. So we'll get into that, I'm sure, a bit later. And then on National Geographic, that other channel, it's entirely a documentary network, and it's more of the male channel in terms of the two that I work on. It's targeting a 25 to 54 demographic, and actually its demo split is about 60-40 men to women. So we've seen quite a bit of rise in women watching that channel. We hit 50-50 at one point, and that wasn't intentional, but it was certainly well received by our advertising team, by the sales group. So that's definitely a different station, but very much devoted to individual strands, one-off documentary, short-run series that will fit within the National Geographic brand, which is very familiar, I'm sure, to many of you. So the clip that I'm going to be showing is from Slice. It's a show called Birthdays. It is a documentary program. It's in its second season. It's a half-hour series. We've just done another 26 episodes of that show. And the reason, it's a series of five different clips, and the reason I've chosen these clips is because, as reported from the producer when we worked with them on this, these clips are actually entirely real, undirected moments. They are, I think, in my mind, a great representation of the natural fun and humor that comes from great casting. And in this particular show, it's all about the trials and tribulations of bringing baby home for the first day from the hospital, and that, well, magazines, some other TV shows, other situations might demonstrate that this is a fun and beautiful moment of your life, it actually can be complete horror and terror for a lot of new parents. First child, second child, it doesn't matter. But so this series is really meant to highlight the drama, but also the fun and craziness that comes along with being first-time parents.
I can't seem to make them burp.
But after Dave takes his leave, Evan takes a fit. So Fred can talk the talk, but can he stop the squawk?
Maybe he just wants to be held. Maybe he wants... I have no idea what he wants.
Perhaps a horrific gap will calm the little guy down.
At the beginning, yeah, changing the diapers now, it wasn't that bad, but lately, the stench has been getting to me, so I've had to step it up and use my respirator, because it really does help. Can't smell anything, it's perfect.
Hands into the plaster.
How the hell are we going to get his hand in there? It's impossible.
Because babies are known to actually space their fingers perfectly and allow you to put them in something.
Well, won't this be fun then? Oh, it's too hard. It's hardened.
But have no fear, because Sue has a backup emergency plaster kit that was probably in the backup emergency plaster kit drawer.
His hand's not going to open up.
No. That's why we should maybe just do his feet.
But Sue ignores Fred's suggestion, because all she hears is, must get perfect handprint.
Do you want to roll up his sleeves?
See?
Hearing a bag ruffle, and I went, hold on, oh my god, oh my god, oh my god. It panicked because I was still breastfeeding and he was latched on good, and at the same time, I needed to get her out of that bag immediately.
That's all I need, is you to suffocate in a plastic bag.
It just reminded me that as much as you're paying attention to one, you have to keep your eye always, or your ear, everything on what the other one's doing at the same time.
Christine has time to visit her pals, or make that co-conspirators. Christine has had 3 kids, and in her opinion, her womb is closed for business forever. But what about Claudia?
Probably can get intercepted.
Yeah, but you know what's funny? He won't.
No,
and his best friend did it, eh? And I'm trying to sound for all the labors and everything I've been through.
But don't they say, yeah, it's like a couple days and it's all over?
Yeah. It's a lot easier for a guy. See,
this ain't no Victorian tea party because Christine's friends aren't shy with their advice.
You know what? That might not be a bad idea.
So how long
say
has
no
been?
Sex before unless you get it done.
Don't tell him I said that.
Oh my gosh. But you know what? But you know what? Honestly, he's the kind of person that would say, oh well, you're lost. And it would be my loss.
My brother didn't
want to
do it, and you know what?
And if that doesn't work, there's always toys for boys.
She bought him a TV. One of those big
screens. Oh, get out. Well, he would love that.
Oh my gosh. That's
but you know what? I'd just rather do it myself.
That's probably good there. I'll just add that the baby, I just have to say this because it scared me to death when I saw the child in the bag, but the producer was just about, or the director, sorry, was just about to step in and remove the bag off the child because they walked in and found the child like that, and the mother came running in the room. So that was, everybody was going to be safe, but it turned into a good TV moment, and everybody was fine.
The producer didn't put the kid in the bag.
No, producer, child found the bag on their own, yes.
Yeah, try this.
No. None of that.
I'm Jesse Fawcett. I'm executive producer at Gala Film and managing director of Gala Film International, which is its pre-sale and distribution arm, which means I do development of new programs and production of new programs and also then sell them internationally once they're completed. Gala Film has traditionally done high-end science and history and drama programs, but we've made a strategic move into factual entertainment lately, which of course can mean a lot of different things. We'll be talking about that. With, for instance, we have a series of Web Dreams on Showcase. We do Doctorology with Discovery, which we'll see a clip of, which stars Leslie Nielsen. And we'll see a clip of a new thing that we're developing around some talent that we found. And we can roll the clips with that. Oh, that's the wrong clip. Oh no, it's the right one, sorry.
Forty forty is 2020.
It is? So,
what are you in here for?
Vitiligo.
Vitiligo?
It's
to skin disease that affects your pigmentation?
Like Michael Jackson.
I didn't know I had a problem with anger.
My eyes felt like they were coming out of my head.
I had cysts.
Burnt my lungs.
I have trouble talking.
As a gastroenterologist, my job is to take care of diseases of the digestive system.
The ear, nose, and throat, it's a tiny area, but it's not.
I decided to go into neurology because I failed every other exam.
Liver!
This piece of equipment is called a phoropter.
So this is the pill can. It takes 2 pictures per second.
PET scan is you inject radioactive material inside of the body.
For a laparoscope, which is a little camera we put in through the belly button.
The cryo gun or sprayer, which is basically a thermos flask with a nozzle on it, and you go.
Is this where the gastroenterology is?
No, dermatology.
Yeah. Sigmoid colon.
Is this part of the test? Help me!
Robert! What happened to your hair?
Sorry.
Welcome to Doctorology.
And I love to cook, create, and entertain. But I'm like Martha, I'm human, and I didn't need jail time to learn how to use my facial muscles. I believe in punk rock, getting my hands dirty, and hot boy toys cleaning up the mess. But enough about me. Let's talk about me. Food turns me on. A perfectly seared tuna steak, the inside pink and buttery soft, all of it drizzled with a sweet and tangy fig reduction. But as much as I love food, I love to laugh. I believe food and comedy are meant to be together, like Sid and Nancy or Rachel Ray and Prozac. Hee hee, yummo! In my world, nothing's sacred and everything's edible. And I've got the recipe for every occasion. And I'm not talking about fisting a turkey with a handful of cashews and the native dead Indians, no. I'm talking about one-night stand breakfasts that are easier to whip up than last night's shag. Hangover hash browns, breakup bechamel, coming out cocoa bank. You get the picture. It tastes as good as I look. I'm all about real situations, real recipes, real booze, at least for the first season. I think it was Nietzsche who said, reality is dead, so pastels. This is Bitchin' Kitchen.
Julie. That's a hard act to follow, that one. Bitchin' Kitchen. I'm Julie from CBC, and about almost a year ago now, we started a new division at CBC Television called Factual Entertainment. And one of the strategy really behind creating this new division is to try and attract audiences outside the sort of loyal and existing audiences that we have at CBC TV, known obviously for our news and our current affairs and documentaries and sports. We really wanted to be able to branch out into genres of television that we weren't necessarily producing, primarily in the genres of talk programs, reality programs, game shows, and lifestyle and afternoon programs. So, you know, just under a year ago, we embarked on this new division. Last year we put 7 new programs on CBC television, several in prime time. I'm going to show a few clips of some of them, also some in daytime. And, you know, what we're really challenged with is just, as I say, as a public broadcaster, is trying to find new ways of making information programming entertaining. And so I've put a little comp reel together of some of the projects that we did this year and that we've broadcast with some success that, in most cases, we'll be repeating next year. And then I'm also happy to talk about other things that we've commissioned. So we can roll the tape, please.
These 5 people are worth over $500 million, and they're ready to start spending their own money on the best business ideas they're pitched.
The number one rule in the
then is you have to get at least what you ask for, or you walk away with nothing.
Hello, dragons. I've obtained a patent for a container with an auxiliary pocket for ready-to-eat foods. I'm looking for $250,000 for 10%.
Oh!
I've only got one single nerve left, and you're getting on it.
Okay.
I am definitely.
Yeah, I can't make that deal.
You want me to finish?
No, actually, I don't.
You're a very sarcastic and arrogant guy.
I'm just impressed with you as an individual.
Listening to you talk, I hear, I would never want to be a partner with this lady.
I like what you're doing.
To zero with a bullet because you're pigs.
I think we got a deal.
Thank you.
This is nuts.
Somebody has to start paying me to sit here. Who's it going to be? I can't take this anymore.
Hi, I'm Rick Mercer, and in just a few moments, we will begin the competition that will determine who will win the title of Canada's next great prime minister. We've narrowed it down to just four candidates. Four candidates who have to impress a panel of judges that includes four former prime ministers. Candidates, this is your first challenge. It is a debate. And remember, this isn't question period. Try to be professional. There may be children watching.
Okay, saying the terrorism it started on September 11th is entirely ignorant.
Did you just quote the president of Iran to make a point?
Sadly.
Joe Clark, any thoughts on that? We're all getting along so well. Peace on Earth is breaking out in the studio. So this is it. It all comes down to this. Ladies and gentlemen, honorable prime ministers, Canada's next great prime minister, Joseph.
For 17 years, Fashion File has brought the glamour of the runway into living rooms around the world. Now, host Tim Blanks is hanging up his mic. And fashion's most fabulous job is up for grabs.
File this under fashion.
10 talented people vie for the opportunity of a lifetime. On Fashion File, host time.
Goodbye. Today's assignment is about style IQ, and there is no room for lightweights.
I'm pretty nervous.
Model one.
I was shocked by some of your performances.
And I just wanted to slap myself silly.
No excuses.
I can nail this.
Your knowledge of fashion is a joke.
This one's gonna be difficult, for sure.
That was Claudia Schiffer.
I love London fashion.
I need you to meet me in Paris.
In Paris?
Do not waste this opportunity.
I saw nothing there that would convince me that she should have been in that room.
I'm not doing this for cameras the way you do.
You scare me sometimes, and actually you're doing that right now. You're a scary person. You're a very scary person.
The first thing I will do if I win this is fall to my knees.
Welcome to Test the Nation IQ, Canada's largest interactive IQ test. Tonight's your chance to get involved and find out how your IQ rates against your family, the country, and our in-studio groups.
This is going to be a lot of fun. Thank you so much, and welcome to Test the Nation IQ, where tonight we find out just how smart we Canadians really are.
Let's meet our teams, the tattoo artists. Ladies and gentlemen, the surgeons. Canada's radio DJs, ladies and gentlemen. We'll see if the smart money is on these people. They're the millionaires. The fitness instructors. The mayors.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
Everyone at home, pencils up. Our Test the Nation IQ test starts right now. Six questions and you'll have 10 seconds for each. Good luck.
The winning team tonight on Test the Nation IQ is the surgeons with an IQ of 119. Congratulations, surgeons. You're the winner.
Congratulations.
So I think all of those clips give a really good, really great example of putting some fun, putting some levity into factual programming. And one of the things that is paramount with this is, I think, and I think everyone here will agree, is that when you're trying to get across something that might be a little heavy, might be a little educational, could be conceived of as dry at some point, one of the best ways to sort of do that without it being, is to popularize it, and that's to infuse comedy into it. But maybe perhaps the producers, distributors here can talk just a little bit about how to do that with the subject. I mean, you took driving and, danger and stuff like that, which is funny, but
yeah,
dangerous.
Yeah, but there's also real stakes, which gives you a lot to play with. Right? I mean, these people actually deeply, there's one of the strengths of the shows, I think, is the casting and the fact that these people are desperately bad at driving. You can play with that as long as it doesn't come from a mean place. So we can basically just enjoy the journey with them. And, we do produce the show. We make sure that things happen. But we don't play dirty. We want to challenge them. We want to take them to the place where their driving goes horribly wrong on a Tuesday afternoon drive. We have to do it in a condensed time frame. So we make things happen. But at the end of the process, they generally are better drivers, and they don't hate me as a result of their experience.
Right. So obviously the casting process is extremely important. If anybody here can address you, Vanessa, the producers or when you're trying to find the people, maybe some of the tricks, or how do you know that, is it just you see them and you just know that these people are going to be fantastic? Or
well, I know in the case of so many of the new shows that we've launched recently, Guys, Newlywed, Nearly Dead as an example, Outlaw, In-Law, Party Mamas, I can say on behalf of all of those producers, like it was unbelievably hard to find the right people, because you do see, unfortunately, more examples of, in those shows cases, couples who don't make great television. I guess the reality is majority of the people out there are regular everyday people, and while we never want to be mean in these shows, which Guy just highlighted, we do want to emphasize the humor and the drama and the conflict and all of those elements. So you're finding people that really are going to shine. So you have to find people that are larger than life, and they're few and far between. In the cases of some of our shows, we have we're going stateside as well to try and do some casting. So like not all of our shows are based out of Toronto, shot out of Toronto, but in the ones that are, we're doing some just in Upper New York or some other just cross-border locations. Certainly not majority of the cases at all, but sometimes you do get those larger-than-life characters just.
It's good to get out of Toronto as well, I would say.
It is.
And it's also amazing how you can meet the people and you think that this person is fantastic and they seem like a larger-than-life character, and you get them on, you shoot them and they're flat. The Nadia G thing that we just saw there, that's a show that she came to us with a fairly convoluted proposal, and we sort of thought, it's okay. And so we test shot it with her, and she just pops, and she just, as you can see, she just comes right off the screen, and we just thought, okay, we'll build something around you. No, you're fabulous, you have talent, we'll build something around you based on that. So I mean, it's really important to shoot people and test them.
I was just going to add, we had a particular casting challenge with Dragon's Den, because not only did you have to be good on camera, but you had to put up $250,000 of your own money. So that counts a lot of people out. We were remarkably lucky, even this is a format that that we bought from Sony Pictures Television and that the BBC had produced. And so we'd seen the way they'd done their version. And I think we were able to find people actually that weren't well known, despite some of their companies are very well known. And the trick of it was that if they were self-made people, which is what you need to be on this kind of entrepreneurial show, then they got it and they really stepped up to the plate. And this show, really coming out of the fact that we had done at CBC a lot of different business programs, when we saw this, we said, well, in a very different package, this represents the kind of entrepreneurial spirit that we've been doing in various shows on CBC television for a long time. So it was something that we were really taken by when we first saw it, because it wrapped all the drama of pitching, really, and getting money and starting a business into a very sort of discreet package.
Okay.
Do you have any questions? Sure.
Yeah.
There's a mic on its way.
Hi, Adam Black from Sustainability TV. Love the fact that you're hitting mainstream audiences. That's kind of where we're at. And I'm kind of interested where each of you went from a pitch point of view, because the idea is the idea, and then it's all dependent on casting, and that's where you start spending money. I'm very interested where you, how you went about from concept through to getting some money to do what you needed to do, whether you developed it yourself, and at which level and who within the various networks you worked with financed the initial development.
That's probably a good question for Guido.
Yeah, well, my case is a little bit unique, so I'm not sure how helpful it is, but I had directed the UK version when I used to live in the UK, so I directed Britain's Worst Driver, but I was already living in Canada at that point, so basically Discovery kind of came to me with the idea of doing the show, because there was no one else in Canada who directed it. So.
Did you own the format?
No, I did not. I have to pay oodles of money to Mentorn every time I make the show, but I know I was a gun for hire at Mentorn in London. So that's how that particular one came about. So it's not particularly illuminating, I don't think, but that's how it happened.
Yeah,
right.
Well, Doctorology came about. We had Leslie Nielsen first. Nadia G, we paid for ourselves. And it just as a producer, it just seems like every year we're having to pay more and more and more of the development costs ourselves. Just every year, you know, 5 years ago, even it was, you know, we could sell shows with a good pitch and some paper, but now almost everyone wants tape.
Yep.
With your talent and stuff.
At which level of the broadcaster did you hit? Did you just go to documentaries? Did you go to entertainment?
No, we knew we focused. We knew that it was going to be a Discovery show. The Doctorology knew it was a Discovery show and a Discovery Health show in the U.S. And so we just went directly to them, and it stuck. It's pretty hard to go wrong with Leslie Nielsen on board too.
So in terms of, I guess, I think maybe one of the things that you were getting at was when you're developing things, you're also pre-selling in the international market, and sort of, you know, the paper format is not something that works. Sort of, there was a time when people thought it might, but the international broadcasters and producers, when they don't only want to see some footage, they want to see a show that performs and that has some ratings behind it before you take it out. And I mean, this part of the industry in Canada, in English Canada, I should say, is just really developing with Canadian producers really starting to come to the fore with some really great, really internationally marketable formats that I think within the next year you're going to certainly see some Canadian devised formats flying in the UK and flying sort of around the world. There's been a little bit of dabbling in there, but I do think that that's going to kind of take off. But maybe you can sort of talk about what, you know, so you've got this idea, you've got this show, or you've got this idea for a show, and you think it could be formatable. What do you need to have? What do you need to take? What elements do you, what's in your package? And who do you go with? Do you sell it yourself, or do you go with a format distributor?
On Doctorology, it didn't even occur to me, in fact, that this formatable until I was at the market, and a UK producer came to me and said, you know, we love the show, we'd love to do some versions of that in Europe, do a German version, do a French version, you know, take similar characters, Leslie Nielsen and David Lawrence, and spin them off. And that didn't even occur to me. I mean, it probably should have, but it didn't. And so now that's something, an avenue that we're pursuing. Coming up with I don't know, you can speak more to sort of the buying of the formats. We're just getting into that now. We've picked up an Australian format, a New Zealand format, and we're just sort of getting into that game. And it's actually, we're finding, I mean, it wasn't until fairly recently, and you two can speak to this, that Canadian broadcasters were even receptive to formats. It was really, what, maybe 3-4 years ago, maybe?
Oh, at the
three,
most, yeah.
Yeah, 3 years ago, maybe.
Even in the last year, it's changed quite a bit.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, two of the things that were on the CBC tape were formats. What Dragon's Den is a Sony Pictures television format, and Test the Nation is an iWorks format. The other ones, one of them, the Canada's Next Great Prime Minister, we created inside the CBC, and we are in a partnership at the moment with that program, with Distraction Formats, to distribute it. And we were in MIP TV last week and had a lot of interest in the Next Great Prime Minister, which would be called the Next Great Leader in any other country. But I think, interestingly enough, there's a lot of people that I spoke to who said, oh, we've been struggling with how to do civics in an interesting way, how to do political responsibility in an interesting way, how to find a way to talk about leadership and to talk about political leadership and not make it dry and boring and uninteresting. So we were surprised at how much reaction we've had. So, you know, part of the mandate that we're working to is both to acquire and localize international formats that work particularly for a public broadcaster, which is a unique thing because it's non-commercial, sort of, and also to create formats ourselves and be able to market and distribute them.
I think it's important to add also that as an independent producer, it's virtually impossible to make a living off of producing formats in one territory. You know, by the time you pay your fee off to the format producer, and then you have the rest of the world, you know, you don't have any distribution rights or anything like that. I mean, it's really, really difficult. And I think going forward, it'll become much more of a broadcaster's game, where they'll sort of, you know, hand them over to producers, which is also sort of
It builds relationships, though, right? That's why we do it. Right?
Yeah.
We'll do that one if we can pitch another one. Kind
of exactly. Thing. Or if it has an ancillary angle to it, yeah. Since it's like American Idol, where you've got a dial and it can bring in money from other angles. But as an indie, you know, as part of our broader strategy, we sort of look, you know, we're not really interested in formats overall unless it has that extra angle to it.
Vanessa, how about you in terms of, you know, formats on your channels?
Well, majority of the shows, certainly on Slice, they're not owned by Alliance Atlantis. They're co-ventures or co-productions with independent producers who, in some cases, are keeping and distributing the formats. In other examples, those rights may revert back to Alliance Atlantis distribution, but that would just be where everybody agreed the distribution should land. In terms of just a slightly unique scenario, is I picked up a format on a show that actually just launched this week. It was truly just a format I got from a producer, TWI, or IM, TWI, IMG through TWI, based out of New York. It wasn't a show that was being picked up by American broadcasters yet. They were floating it around, but nobody was picking it up. And I really like the format. It's called Rocker Moms. And we actually were ready to make it. And no U.S. broadcaster was coming on, so we just bought the format and then, of course, licensed it to Canadian producer Tricon in this case, and they made the show for us. It's now available, of course, as a produced show, but the format still exists for a U.S. broadcaster or any other broadcaster for that matter, non-Canadian, to pick it up. So we did it, an unproven example, and of course it just launched, so we don't know whether it's working here yet or not, but hopefully it will.
Maybe you can talk, and Julie especially, talk about some of the Canadian-American issues with picking up a format that is either already sold or is being shopped in the U.S. And some of the sort of issues that go back and forth, whether how it is to play with the American networks who may be developing at the same time as you are, or you know may have turned down something, and what sort of the, where the balance is there, you know, and what model you do. Do you launch something like American Idol with what CTV did, and then do the Canadian format on the back, or do you do the Canadian format first, and sort of how that plays?
It's tricky, but so far for us, I think what makes the most sense is to, I mean, we talked about this earlier, but a show like Wife Swap, for example, once these shows have gone to the U.S. from the U.K., I don't think it makes much sense to do them in Canada because you can watch the U.S. version. A show like that can be really localized, like Dragon's Den, which in some way was American Inventor, was a whole bunch of other things that were in the U.S. But I think Dragon's Den came to us, well, through Sony, but after it was at the BBC.
I think Dragon's Den originally came from Japan.
Japan, it did, yeah, it came from Japan. And so for us, I mean, in our particular point of view is that generally shows that are social experiments, we can talk about that, but things that... I mean, Worst Driver is a social experiment in a way. Things that come from the UK are probably better for us before they've gone into the US market, because otherwise then they're just, you know, they're broadcast here, and why would somebody watch it? Somebody talked to me about The Biggest Loser, same sort of thing. Like, at the end of the day, we can, you know, heavy people are heavy people, no matter where they are. But, you know, I think if you can find something that you can really localize before it's been produced in the States, that that would be right for us.
Idea.
Yeah.
Although just to add to that, because certainly majority of the really popular formats that we'd love to air are coming across on mainstream television. Another example of one we just picked up was actually Project Runway. So we're making Project Runway Canada. And of course, that is an example of where we have run the US version,
right.
But it's not on main cable, right?
Yes.
So it's not coming across. You're seeing it as an acquisition on Slice, but it's not obviously so widely distributed that everybody's aware of it. So it's in those few cases, maybe, where there might be a proven hit on a cable, a US cable network,
yeah.
That you can find a unique opportunity.
Okay. Any questions? Sure, over here.
I just wanted to ask Julie and Vanessa, how are you able to work with the CTF funds with this kind of programming? Like, what have you been able to get through the fund? That would be great.
Well, we talked about this a little beforehand. Mm-hmm. It's not easy. I mean, or we were talking about it. I think really for the business model for us as it relates to factual and game shows and formats, you can't get funding for them. So, you know, what we're really trying to do is generate revenue from sponsorship. I mean, the Dragon's Den, General Motors, Cadillac was built into the show. It's hard to get funds for formats, for game shows, for those kinds of things. So we're looking at a different model that revolves around generating revenue from advertising, sales, and sponsorship, and those sorts of things. Interactive back ends. We talked about this a little bit earlier, but Test the Nation was a ginormous participatory thing. Again, Quaker was our sponsor, and they were just thrilled with over 200,000 Canadians spent, you know, more than an hour online filling out a national IQ test and spending time with, you know, with the show and with what it offered. So that's sort of the business model that's developing around the programs.
In the case of Slice, it has a CTF envelope, and National Geographic, a much, much smaller one, so there's not a lot of examples there, or we'll work with our sister station History, maybe it's in that route. It's tough to do. There's four shows off the top of my head that I'm remembering that are CTF on the Slice schedule, which, in considering it's 82% Canadian content, that's not a lot that go through the fund. Because as Julie said, it's not ultimately where all of them can go towards. It's you know, the formats need to. We need to create the show that's going to be the most suitable for the goal of the channel and ultimately popular for the target audience. And it doesn't necessarily take us down a clear-cut documentary stream. Mm-hmm. So.
Right. So how, with financing and funding, you're both open to sponsorship. You know, what are your sort of main concerns? And when a producer comes to you, do you want them to come to you with a sponsor in mind, have a deal tied up already? You know, what do you need?
Well, I think, now I also want to say that it's not impossible to have, I mean, I'm listening to Vanessa say she can remember four shows, and we do have some shows that we think, you know, are in the docu-soap kind of, I think we have to still push that envelope, you know, in terms of whether there are parts of some of these shows that can actually, that you could apply to the CTF and maybe get a favorable ruling. So I think we should try.
Yeah.
But beyond that, you know, we've got a marketing sales division now with a year sort of behind them in terms of these factual programs and finding the right kind of fit with the clients that we already have. So it's great for somebody to come in with a proposal and a suggestion of where we might go or how something, we're doing a show coming up this fall with Phil Kogan, from the host of the amazing race called No Opportunity Wasted, and he's done the show in New Zealand before. Long story short, Vodafone was the sponsor because they were worked into the story concept, so we have this discussion about should we kind of replicate that. So I think it's great to have those discussions, but it's really not, you know, at the end of the day, we do have a marketing sales division that's their job, really, is to find these opportunities. But if the producer brings connections or you know, or past experiences or any of those sorts of things, that's even better.
As a producer, when we're pitching shows, we just had this discussion last week at MIP. We've got a program that has a big ancillary partnership with it. If I, because the show is ultimately has to be a great show. I mean, it doesn't matter who the partners that you bring on, who, how much money they have. If the show, if people aren't going to want to watch the show, it doesn't matter. So we tend to ignore all of the ancillary and partnership aspects of that, and we just focus when we're selling shows and pitching shows. We just talk about the show, and then let it stand on its own merit, and then we can bring in the other aspects when they come on.
There's also just a, you know, this is getting into real detail around it, but you have to also there's a proper weighting and everything in terms of how much sponsor involvement and everything in a show as it starts to get into advertising or CRTC guidelines of crossing into sponsorship. So
yeah.
I think that goes back to when you work, we need to work with our own sales departments, and then what we know is the guidelines, and I think each network has pretty clear guidelines as to how they work with the CRTC to make sure you don't cross those boundaries. So that's why I think it's good if somebody has an idea, but really the legwork's done by that broadcaster.
Right, right. Okay. Any other questions? Sure, right up here.
I would like to know what are your experiences with flops, what didn't function, and why did it not function?
Nice.
Wow, we have no experience in
this. All hits.
Luckily, Guy and I get to look to them for the answer for that.
Let's talk to you. Maybe
okay,
more.
I'm going to on Slice. It's,
what
it's
maybe didn't work the way or as well as you had thought it might, you know, and why?
You know, in all fairness, we just launched this network on March 5th, so it's a little too early to start. I don't want to start
maybe
advertising
talk about
flops.
Can we talk about acquisitions, factual
acquisitions?
Yeah,
absolutely.
That, you know.
Let me think. I know there's probably a lot of examples.
Julie, do you have any examples?
Yeah, I mean, we, I think, you know, in terms of the CBC and what we're trying to do is send out some different messages about the kind of programming we're making so we can attract some different audiences. So I think when, you know, when you're on a path to change the direction to a certain degree of a public broadcaster and to make it more accessible to a greater number of people, two of the shows that I showed there, every show that I showed there didn't meet the audience target we had planned for them. I wouldn't call them flops, but I would, the only one that sort of way overachieved was Test the Nation, which told us something about that type of show and a public broadcaster and how the fit seemed to really resonate. But Dragon's Den, for example, was, I think, such a departure for where our schedule had been that it started very low in terms of ratings, although it was the fastest growing show that we had all year. So I think our challenge is to say, you know, how do you let people know that you're doing a variety of different programs and how do you bring new audiences to them? And it was a little bit the same with Fashion File Host Hunt, which was motivated essentially by the fact that we've had a fashion brand for a long time and the host was leaving and we wanted to kind of reinvent the show. So this was a way to do it. And I think Tricom produced it for us. I think it's just an absolutely fantastic show. And it was in the early evening. I don't think it got the ratings that it deserved. And I think part of that is because when you're engaged in a bit of a transition on a network from here to there, it takes a little while to say, oh, and by the way, we have this too. And to figure out just how to schedule and program a network when you're adding a whole new genre of television in. So I don't know if I would call them flops necessarily, but they're certainly, you know, in terms of meeting targets and meeting ratings targets and that sort of thing, there's some challenges along the way for sure.
Anybody else? I have a question sort of, oh, no, we have one question.
I was going to ask a question relating to the fact that format television isn't very difficult to get grants for from the various people. So that's bad for Canadians who need money to make shows, but it's also an opportunity for other people who maybe don't need those grants. Do you take format shows from international or create formats which have Canadian subject matter made by non-Canadians? Would you deal with something like that? Because ultimately, if you don't need the money from those parties that give it, and they're not going to give it for those format shows anyway. What's the, are there any issues there?
I don't think so. I mean, as long as that, I mean,
so you're talking sort of
the model. As an Australian and English American-based producer, I speak to a lot of broadcasters in Canada. Oh, Canadian content must be Canadian content, must be Canadian authorship and all of that. And I have Canadian partners, but obviously sometimes we like to do it ourselves. And a lot of the barriers that we have as international producers is this whole sort of Canadian content because of the Canadian financing structures. Mm-hmm. Format shows, which is actually what we really make, we don't think should have those problems. So I'm interested to speak in the broadcasters here and their opinion about whether they would treat a non-Canadian the same way they would treat a Canadian, given the fact that they don't necessarily need the funding, providing it's relevant to your audience, of course.
Well, we do have this show that I mentioned before that Phil Kogan brought us with a Canadian producer partner attached to it, so that would be the same. I mean, he's a New Zealand guy, and he's done the show there, and so I think the answer would be no. I mean, we're already in a relationship. I mean, he's got a Canadian partner, but as long as it's being shot here and it's Canadians who are starring in the series and that sort of thing, I don't think there's a problem with that.
And I believe the Canadian content, the idea behind Canadian content is that it's produced by Canadians. In the terms of the license of the channel licenses are that, you know,
they need
what's
a certain
80% or something.
Yeah. To be Canadian,
yeah.
Right?
So
it's that's hard where, to put it in.
I would guess outside of that 80%.
Yeah, there's the problem is that at 80% or 82% on in my case, it's that's where the investment's going to go. So when you've got that much of your content, that's where you're going to fill. It doesn't leave a lot of dollars left for non-Canadian content. Because there's just that's you have to put it
which that piece you'd normally fill probably with acquisitions
for already made acquisitions
spending,
yeah,
know, that much
not
more money
not
to
doing pre-sales or anything like that. No,
it's protectionism and I'm all for it.
Does anyone else have anything they'd like to find out? I have a question about trends. You know, factual television, the whole television business seems to be, and factual television and formats more than anything else seem to be about trends. Somebody gets this great idea and everybody else seems to pile on. I think that may be starting to change a little bit. There were some real problems, and I think there's still some lawsuits going on about that kind of thing. But in terms of trends, is there anything that anybody here can pull out that might be just about time that Canada do it? We were talking about shock docs. And what they are, social experiments.
I think everybody's looking for the next new hybrid that nobody thought of. Mm. There's a show on BBC Three right now, apparently, called Fat Men Can't Hunt. It sounds just a fantastic mixture of sort of natural history and kind of diet lifestyle. I just think that's, you know, everybody's looking for that new weird combination, including me.
I just got back from MIP, where the trend or the talk of the market was green, everybody's talking about. And I found, as somebody wanting to pick up green and environmental programming for National Geographic, and even for Slice for that matter, that there was definitely a supply and demand issue. Everybody's asking, but in terms of existing product,
and
or
there's
even...
there's going to be a glut at
some
point.
Yeah, that it's not enough to fill the demand out there, and everybody's looking for it in different shapes and sizes to suit their schedule's needs. So then the key is when it is made, like, what's the quality of it? Is everybody repetitive of everybody else's message, and finding a way to now do it well and unique and keep it unique?
Yeah, we found that. We had a green show that wasn't green, but it was green enough that everybody wanted it.
Yeah.
So same thing. Yeah.
Really.
Yeah. Game shows seem to be obviously coming back in a big way. That's. I mean, it's the ebb and flow.
Well, we did talk about that earlier too. Mm. Just the whole, you know, one of the things we're trying to be very aggressive about right now, just because we have the, you know, the luxury of having. Been in the TV business and have an archive that's over 50 years old for programs, is we're looking at all of the game shows that we've done in the past and that we own the rights to, and trying to say, including Front Page Challenge and a few other ones that were well known in this country years ago, to say, well, you know, where's the original DNA of that show and what could today's version of it be? And so I think that not necessarily is that a trend, although I think it is a trend, because when you talk to some, you know, the Fremantles of this world and some of the other big companies, you get a sense that they're really delving back into broadcast archives and finding out what else can be done with some of these shows. So I agree on the green and the environmental. It seems to be something that everybody's talking about, except I still worry because I'm not sure people watch these shows. No matter what we do, I don't see any examples of highly rated shows that are green in nature.
It's been a trend
it's too
before.
Earnest, yeah.
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 Yeah. But I think we talked about a few earlier. I think there are some really great ideas about how to make it interesting and informative at the same time, which would be great. So that to come, I suppose.
But I think it's probably how you treat them, and I'm sure that with the green programming, it's the exact same principles that apply as with anything else. Mm-hmm. It's the casting, it's the story, it's mm-hmm. the stakes, and you just have to sort of find that and see what the magic formula is that works.
Well, the only thing is that it's so scary to people. You know, it's a bit like doing healthcare stories. You know, I mean, at the end of the day, I think the problem is that everybody. It's the doom and gloom around the green movement that is so overwhelming to a certain degree that it's difficult. I think that people are.
I think what I'm hearing, C21 just before MIP did, that was our cover story. It was pretty much everybody's, was the green programming, and speaking to commissioning editors sort of all over the world, there's definitely been that tide that's turning. I think a couple years ago it was all the disaster stuff, mm-hmm. You know, England's going to sink, and you know, we're all going to die, all of that stuff. And now it seems like pretty much everybody wants the proactive stuff. From Sundance in the States, who just launched their big green block, or I think they will this fall, to the lifestyle networks. Everybody wants something that lets give somebody some hope that they can actually do something, profiles people that are doing things, profiles green industry, you know, sort of in a kind of interesting way. I think one of the most interesting things that I saw was a show that's on HGTV. You probably know this, the Ed Begley Jr. one. Mm-hmm. And I think it's done really well for them. Mm-hmm. You know, sort of following him, it's the interplay between his wife, who is not the most green person naturally, but she's sort of dragged into this by him, and it's a bit of a docu-soap, so that's another way to kind of treat that. Mm-hmm.
Hi, my name's Jillian. I was wondering, what about urban shows as a trend? Like Make Some Noise, I absolutely love that show. I think Fashion File Host Hunt is urban. I was wondering about urban shows as a trend in Canadian TV.
I never think about shows in terms of whether they're urban or not. I just don't have that frame of reference. I'm sure that's my fault, but I just don't.
Yeah. No, I can't say it's something that's ever occurred to me just as a genre. Mm. Maybe I should.
Quite willing to shoot in built-up areas.
You know, yeah. I think, well, before we were talking just sort of about comedy and things that are funny, and you know, we were looking at Little Mosque, and you said mm-hmm. that, it, you know, something like that is great because it does give you an eye into somebody else's world, so maybe there's an unexplored niche there, mm-hmm. you know?
Well, it is, I mean, especially at the CBC, we tended to situate a lot of our shows and storylines outside the big urban centers. And I mean, you know, the demographic trend is 80% of us in this country live in urban centers, which is still a remarkable thing, you know, and there's just three or four of those. But I haven't really thought about it in terms of, you know, being pitched shows that are sort of intensely urban in any way, but I don't know, it could be an idea.
Mm-hmm. Sorry to bring up the States, but I know that they're constantly asking for more urban shows, more diverse shows, and wondering where the producers are with them, why are there not more available? So this is what I told at other festivals. Mm-hmm. But,
mm-hmm. I'll have to take a note on that. I think a big trend, another big trend that we haven't talked about is the docudrama / observational documentary / reality / whatever you want to call it show, which you talk about, you know, putting fun into those, you know, it's taking over a lot of the American cable networks,
yeah.
Almost the majority of their programming is that Bravo, A&E, all of those ones. And those have a ton of, I mean, to me.
Give a couple titles as an example.
Well, I mean, Dog the Bounty Hunter was sort of the one that all the networks, they say, well, we're looking for something like, kind of like Dog the Bounty Hunter, but the next generation, you know. That one, and there seems to be a big obsession with is that, what Aaron Spelling actually talked about is what most people want to see is the problems of rich people that can't be solved with their money. And that's what that's what his empire was built on, but also we're seeing that a lot. I think almost all of Bravo US's schedule is watching rich people, you know. I mean, all those, what are they?
Real Housewives of Orange County.
There it was.
On Slice and Patrick.
Yeah. To me, these are, they're observational documentaries, but there's also comedy in them as well. You know? It's drama, it's comedy, it's all these things.
Yeah.
I think that's a big trend. That's a very big trend right now. It's just a matter of trying to define, you know, finding one word. If the industry could find one word for it, it'd be great. But every network seems to have its own definition.
Yeah, thanks.
I have a couple of questions. First one is, can you define for me green and nature? What is programming that is green in nature? And the second question is, most of the demographic that broadcasters seem to be aiming for is indeed that 25 to 54 group. Is there any interest at all in an older age group, or, for example, programming that involves an older age group?
To answer your first question, I define, you know, and I have to believe every network may define green a little bit differently depending on their core genre. So, you gave an HGTV example, and they may take, look at it from a home focus of building a brand new home and making sure that it's environmentally friendly in terms of the building materials and ongoing living circumstances. On National Geographic, I'm more about celebrating the environment in its in a healthy state. So it would be anything from programs about marine life, and in terms of recognizing, you know, the status of should there be continued damage to the environment, how that might affect marine life, just as an example off the top of my head. It's not necessarily about being so specific to, I guess what I saw as the original green trend about, you know, recycle, reuse, and just finding the real, true core things about being environmentally friendly. To answer your second question, there are networks that will target an older audience, and there are specific shows that might target an older audience. Usually, as a network whole, certainly a network that's dependent on advertising revenue, they're not going to be aggressively targeting a true older demographic in terms of like a 55 plus demographic. That would be just a very generic basic answer from that perspective.
Julie, I'm sure you have something to say.
Well, on the demographic, I mean, happily, we sort of own the 60 plus demographic at CBC, so we're not actively working to get any more. So we're really focusing on the 25 to 54, which isn't, you know, the 18 to 35, it's the 25 to 54. I think on CBC, I mean, everything, I think the whole green thing is about sustainability. And I mean, we've got everything from, you know, the nature of things with David Suzuki and where it's come from and where it is today. We have lots of documentaries and both on News World and on CBC television that are, that I think are about sustainability in some interesting way. You know, both of our daily shows, which are factual entertainment programs, the Jill Deacon Show, who's a known environmentalist and who also happily works that into almost every single show in terms of Jill's green tips and everything else. So we think that's one way on a daily basis and kind of a lifestyle treatment to do our part. And late night, 11 o'clock, the hour with George Strombolopoulos is also, we don't necessarily have a segment dedicated to it, but sustainability is just I think one of the core editorial points on the program. So that's a range. And, you know, I also think when we were talking about it earlier, I was just thinking at the end of the day, too, there's still a lot of bullshit in this green movement, you know, greenwashing. And a lot of this should still be challenged. I don't think we should be celebrating it. And we do, but I do think we need to celebrate some of it.
For a documentary still I've heard from sort of talking to BBCs and people who, you know, have become authorities on sort of conservation and sustainability, that perhaps not those channels so much would be into something that challenges directly head-on global warming. Is it happening? Is it not happening? Mm-hmm. The general sense I'm getting is that, you know, that everybody pretty much mm-hmm. thinks it's happening. But that, but where there is room for question is things like green fraud, things, mm-hmm. you know, this does this really, does this actually work? You know, does this make a difference? Is, and all of the companies that are piling on, there's other things, sort of nuclear power, and you know, not the most fun necessarily topics, but you can make them. Mm-hmm. I mean, it all depends.
Mm-hmm. Just as an added thing, I don't know if anybody caught the Academy Awards when Leonardo DiCaprio stood up and said, "This is a green production," and I know I personally was scratching my head, like, what the hell does that mean? Especially when they were all rolling up in really environmentally friendly limos, pulling up. And then there was some investigation by a few different people, by a few different producers that I'm aware of afterwards, and there's still not a clear-cut answer as to what that actually meant.
Yeah, I think there's this really big movement right now about becoming carbon neutral, and you know, certain film festivals are carbon neutral, and actually there's a movement here called the Green Code Project that's outside downstairs. I think they have a booth, and they're putting on some stuff tomorrow. In terms of mobilizing the and obviously within factual television, documentary filmmakers, there's across the entertainment industry, it's sort of the in vogue thing to do, but especially with the people that are here, there's definitely, you know, an effort, and the Green Code Project in particular is looking to try and help production companies to become a little less offensive.
My prediction is that the green trend in terms of programming is going to end very quickly. I think it's a bubble that's going to pop. I think it, for two reasons. I think it's become too much of a frenzy. It's like the .com of trends, and also it's hard to make interesting programs about green. I just think that this is going to go away fairly quickly, and we'll be straight back to entertainment very very soon in terms of programming. That's my personal.
We have a question right back there.
I just want to take the opportunity, since we have five great minds up there, just to ask for each of you. What is the one tip you can give people, like, to put, what's the most fun for you in factual? Where do you have the most fun?
Do you want to start at the end.
I really think Guy touched on it earlier, the machinations between creating hybrid teams of people that come from different places, whether they're documentary or entertainment or drama, and finding ideas that are blending teams and ideas that are blending different backgrounds and different expertise, and that bring different things to the table and create something that nobody really has ever thought of or seen before. And to me, that's what's really exciting. And so I think outside the place that you've been, partner with people that you've never, you know, worked with. And there's something creative in that I think can really help us in creating really interesting programs.
For me, I think it's finding a project that you really that you have a vision for, and that has that unique sort of twist or that new angle, and you can feel it in your gut that you know it's going to work, and seeing that through to delivery and having it come out and work. I think that's an incredible life reward.
How do you know it works?
I'm going to say that for me, it's one of the hardest things, but casting it's one of the best things, because honestly, when it works and you kind of you find that perfect person who delivers those fantastic moments, you switch as a programmer to suddenly becoming a viewer, and you instantly find yourself being naturally entertained like you want to be when you sit home, when you go home and sit on your couch and watch TV. And that's just that magic moment that you know this is going to be great TV because you found a really great character.
And I'd probably just say the joy of teaching people stuff without them noticing. You know, just making a show that's big enough and noisy and entertaining enough that they don't even realize that they learned something.
Mm. For me, I don't make television, I write about it, but I watch for a bit of it. You know, it's the banal in the everyday, it's the moments that in programming that across the board here, the things that you sort of see that you can identify with. It has to speak to you in order for it to be funny, really. And one thing I just want to say too is we have somebody here, Albert Nirenberg, who knows how to put the fun into factual and does it quite effectively. So I don't know, what do you find funny, Albert?
I don't know if I'm asking this panel is carbon neutral or not.
I'm wearing green.
I don't know. I think there's a really interesting issue here, which is this question of, as the world apparently gets scarier and gloomier, what is funny? And I sort of got a feeling that part of the answer here, in terms of programming trends, is avoid it. And I actually think that evidence is suggesting otherwise. Like, for example, I think the reason why The Little Mosque on the Prairie is such a big hit and is such a great thing is because here we had the clash of civilizations, a frightening, terrifying thing, and the CBC just stuck this beautiful comedy right in the middle of it. Yeah. And I think that was beautiful and great for civilization. So I actually think that, you know, there is some, I do think, you know, the question I would ask is, it seems to me that, you know, as people that are setting trends, you might have some choice here, which is, you might have a choice faced with the kind of gloominess and, you know, scariness of current trends, that you have a choice to choose programming that is moving to distraction, let's just avoid it, or let's have a good time, which I think there's a place for that in life, of course. Or is there a way to find humor and entertainment in these serious things that kind of relieve pressure and enlighten at the same time?
Yeah. Does anybody want to address that?
Oh, I think you're right, Albert. I think it needs a big dose of humor for sure. And I think that's true.
I think that's why, that's sort of, I'm interested why you think that the idea is to avoid it, because I really don't think it is. Mm-hmm.
No, I don't think we're avoiding it. No, I mean, I think that's where the passion is. If that's where the passion lies and mistakes lies, then that's where, you know, comedy and content can lie. Right? That's good material.
Yeah, I think it's a little more difficult in factual than it is in scripted. In scripted, you have it's much easier to address those things, certainly than in factual. It is hard to get, you know, on the factual side to address those things, for sure. But I think you're right with the Little Mosque Prairie. It's a good example.
Do you have a point to make, Vanessa?
No, I'm going to agree with everybody. I don't think we're avoiding it,
Sometimes it's hard. It takes a lot of work to find.
Yeah, humor to everyday situations that are sometimes depressing is very tough, but it's doable. I think there's a lot of examples of networks doing that really, really well.
Right, for sure. Yeah.
I feel a little bit rude because I've spoken three times.
I can't
stop myself. Every single thing that you've talked about here and this gentleman over there hit on is kind of what we're doing. I feel I've got to introduce myself because I've been talking about everything I'm doing at the moment. My name's Adam Black. I'm the producer of Sustainable TV. We're based in Australia, UK, and our main base is in New York. We have a show called Earth 2.0. This time you're going to get it right. It is very amusing and very factual. It's where the rubber meets the road of
this
the journey to sustainability. This is not a pitch session, but I just wanted to say, because of what you've all said, and particularly because of this, let's get some irony in there, and what you said, and particularly because the Financial Times is going on about carbon credits at the moment. They haven't quite worked it out yet, and it's coming to the fore. All of these things need to be addressed with a humor and a bit of fun, but deliver message. That's what we're doing. I hope I get a chance to speak to you all later.
Yeah, I think maybe one of the themes that sort of come out here is it's whatever is difficult can be really funny. There's humor in things that are difficult, and not in the sense, it has to be in a sense that you identify with these people.
Yeah, not in a mean-spirited way.
It's not funny to watch somebody fall on their face, but it's, wow, it's slapstick, you know, in a really serious sense, not in a physical sense, but it, you know, there are opportunities for humor wherever there's emotion, wherever there's intense emotion, there are opportunities for humor. I think we've, you know, that there's that old thing about being at a funeral and somebody just starts smirking, and it's the emotion of the situation, and it, you know, it's just one of life's kind of things.
Hi. I have a question going back to, you know, putting the fun and factual in terms of trying to reach a broader audience, and where's the fine line between dumbing down and reaching out, and on the other hand is the whole marketing content production for content as opposed to being a support for selling ads. Because I think these days with the convergence of many different, you know, entities within the media world, before we had ads between the news to finance the news, and it seems today we have news between the ads to actually sell the ads, if you see what I mean. So how do you draw the line between reaching a broader audience versus dumbing down and, you know, creating content for the sake of being educational and factual as opposed to just giving networks another mean of selling marketing? And just as a footnote on the bubble, the environment bubble bursting or not, I happen to be a freelance journalist in health and environment and economy, and I think it may disappear, but if it disappears, it's because it's going to become mainstream. And right now, we're really close to the tipping point.
Yep.
And there's definitely a need for hope, and there's solutions out there. Everything's cool. The documentary playing here really highlights the whole sort of media relations and public relations stance. But I think if as you think, the bubble burst, in my opinion, is that it's because it's going to become mainstream.
Yeah.
And so, but anyhow, going back to my question, you know, dumbing down or broader audience and, you know, marketing versus content?
It's a tough question. One example that I come up with is a show that we do, Web Dreams for Showcase, which is a show about docu-soap about the online porn industry. And on one side, it's really a salacious, sexy show that sort of has all the titillation of a reality show. But on the other hand, it's a genuine docu-soap that has real depth of character in it. So I think you can do both well. It's hard to do. It's really hard to do. But you know, no one wants to get talked down to, I don't think. And you can have great programs that are highly entertaining without sort of dumbing down to people. I think you know, I find the Surreal Life. I think the Surreal Life is a brilliant show for it on its own merits. You know, I think it's really well done. They take the way they put that together and turn a bunch of banal, dumb characters into really entertaining, funny television. I think it's great television making. I don't know. What do you think about it?
I don't agree with dumbing down, but I do believe that you can be mass appeal by being relatable and being entertaining without talking down to people. Mm-hmm. Everybody has a different version of what's entertaining. Also, everybody has a different version of what they find funny. So it's a really fine line as to how much you get into humor to make your show, you know, be fun, entertaining, and funny. And then other ones, somebody else might consider how, you know, The Surreal Life, as an example, that crosses the barrier of being completely dumbed down, potentially trash television, but it's everybody's got a different opinion of it. So I think it's to try to be mass appeal to get the best audience and the biggest audience, if that's your goal, but not be mean or manipulative to certain too many degrees.
Yeah, I mean, I guess commercial TV will always skew towards disposable dollars, but there seems to be more platforms for all sorts of content now than there ever have been. You know, we think, you know, blogging, internet, and so on. There's always going to be some tension with the market, but it ain't so bad.
Julie, did you want to address that? CBC is the...
And public
broadcasting. Yeah, yeah, I was just thinking you have a different...
I mean, you've got to reach everybody.
You're trying to do both.
I think that... I don't think particularly in the shows that we've done so far, and we will continue to do that I would, I mean, my formerly I was a news journalist and I was responsible for the current affairs and weekly programming on our news channel and on CBC television. And I think what's going to make us successful in factual is that actually we come from a strong information history and it's an experience of documentaries and social documentaries and all that sort of thing. So I think it's really rooted in strong storytelling and a history of credibility. That's the good thing, that's also the bad thing, because you know you have to push it beyond that. But I do think that, I don't think that there's any program that we've done that I would ever consider that we've dumbed anything down. I think actually it's some of the smartest TV that we've ever done and also the most entertaining at the same time. So I don't think that these things they're not mutually exclusive. I mean, they can go together. And as it relates to the marketing end of it, I mean, what I see happening is as the kind of commercial model falls apart to a certain degree because of PVRs and all that sort of other thing. You know, there's a lot of interest by corporations. We look at things like the Dove Beauty campaign and others to say, how can we talk about what we do you know, in and through television sponsorships and these kinds of things. But that's not, for us, that's not the starting point. That's just that, you know, we create something like a Test the Nation or Dragons or whatever else it is, and then we say what could be a partnership that doesn't in any way affect the program that we want to make and the appeal that we want it to have. So I'm not really worried about that either. I think that you have to be, I mean, the only real challenges that we've had, but, you know, we've got around some of them, is taking also a known journalist like Wendy Mesley and putting her into a game show format that's sponsorable, and being able to keep the personalities separate in terms of their credibility and that sort of thing, but nothing that isn't insurmountable. And so the key thing is really to keep your, I think, your reputation, your credibility, and make entertaining programming.
We have a question right at the back there. Oh, okay. Have you got a mic? Yeah.
Hi, yeah. First, I just wanted to say thank you. This is a great practical session for us so that we can go back and create a pitch and a package that hopefully won't be, you know, we'll have learned something here. And my question is, again, about the pitch and about this, about docu-soaps and about reality TV shows and about how much money.
Don't call it reality.
Pardon?
Don't call it reality.
No, sorry. Well, you know, we're working with, I have an example here. A fabulous young person came to our production company, has this idea for a wonderful show, and we are new to this genre, and so we're wondering, how should we put our package together? We want to create something that when it comes to you, it won't be too much sizzle, right? We don't want it to be over the top. We have this great vision. We want you to see what it is, but at the same time, we don't want to spend all our money on one particular pitch, right? So do you have any advice for what it is that, you know, what comes to you and what it is that you need to see that, you know, won't make us all sort of poor production companies?
Actually, that was my question as well, as everyone talked about, you need a video element now, you need to bring more than paper. So what, same question is there.
Yeah.
I mean, I can speak to that a little bit, because it is a difficult one for smaller producers. One thing I'm trying to do now is actually, I mean, generating tape is enormously expensive, so it's a real difficult one if the broadcaster insists on that. But at the same time, I'd be a bit wary about getting into development deals, because there's a danger attached to that as well. I mean, that's the obvious way. You make a pitch. You know, they throw some seed money at you and you can generate the idea, but then that can also kill the idea if they then decide not to pick it up and you can't then take it anywhere else. So it's a difficult balancing act, and I guess it depends how long you've been doing it and how much success you've had probably determines which way you decide to go, but it's a real issue either way.
And I would say for docu-soap in particular, it's a really specialized field of production that you really, really have to know your stuff. It's a real craft, specialized craft. I would partner with a company that knows how to do that for docu-soaps.
I enjoyed the film, by the way. You did the Toronto film, right? Enjoyed that, yeah.
Sorry, I just have a follow-up question. How well developed does the web multimedia part of it need to be? Because everyone talks about it. but do we need to have that? How far does that need to be developed before we come to you?
Well, I think pretty safe to assume, and you'll look into it before you meet with a broadcaster to pitch them a show, find out what their web content is, what it already exists. I know in the case of our networks, every single channel has its own website, and within that website, depending on the size of the production or the goal of that particular production, there'll be microsites and various spin-offs within that site. So in some cases, that development would happen with the producer hand in hand. In other cases, it might be better developed through the Bell New Media Fund or something like that. So I go back to, it's a case-by-case basis in terms of, does the program suit a large web component, and then how that might spin off into development. I do think it's fair to assume that networks these days are anticipating, if they're making a significant investment, that they're going to want those rights. That's pretty common practice nowadays, web rights and new media rights.
A whole,
and I'm just going to disagree with Guy completely on development.
That's fine.
Because
so am I, actually.
Yeah.
I'm going to stay out of this.
development is key. Like, it's so important.
It needs
important.
To get done. It's just that under what basis?
Yeah. I'm kidding. It does need to get done, and definitely it makes, you know, broadcasters need to help finance them. If they can finance them completely, that's a great situation, but often that isn't the case. We don't want shows going to air unless they're perfect, and if you're figuring out perfect by episode 5, it's not doing network or producer any favors, because it's not going to generate the audience that you need, and you don't, and it's not going to get renewed, and it's just a snowball. That's just the very general sense of it.
Julie, do you have last comments on that?
Well, yeah, I just think, I mean, at first, all we're looking for really is a one-page summary of your concept, your idea, what it is you want to do, because it might not, it just might be so something that we're not interested or we're really interested, and then that's enough to begin with, you know? And then I think if it is something that we're interested in, that, you know, that it always helps to talk about these things, particularly if, you know, if you're not experienced in the area of pitching. And then at least if we're interested, that's going to lead to a conversation with one or more of the production executives or the development executives or whatever it is. And then we can talk through and say, okay, you know, what would we need to know that this was something we actually wanted to spend some money developing? What are the deliverables, essentially? And it's different with every project. It depends. Do you need some tape? If you're coming in and you're pitching a personality-based show, we need to see that person, because unless we already know who that person is, there's no way that, you know, that you can say, oh yeah, I trust your judgment, this person would be terrific. So, but I think it differs with every project. And on the multi-platform stuff, It's a tricky one. We've just actually hired and included a digital executive to work with us, whose sole responsibility would be working with outside producers and also the inside producers to sort of say, does this idea warrant a sort of major multimedia or digital strategy? In most cases, actually, the answer is no. Some cases, it's absolutely, like Test the Nation or that kind of thing. If there's voting involved, those sorts of things. And then if there is, then we try and figure out together what are the ideas. And I would just encourage people to think about it not in technical terms, but in programming terms. Okay, I have the small screen to program, and then I have the phone potentially to program on, and I've got this idea, and then I can also program online. What are the various ideas that you can come up with? Because at the end of the day, it's not about all the hard wire and who pushes what content to whom. It's about what idea can sustain across many platforms. So just bring the ideas, and then we can figure out how they can work.
Okay, well, that just about wraps it up. Thank you very much for coming to the panel.